Hello, fellow neuromarketing people.
Hi, who's this?
This is Ingrid.
Hi, Ingrid. I'm Eric.
Hi, Eric. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. Where are you?
I live in Colorado.
Good for you.
I do like it here. How about you?
I live in Mamaroneck, New York.
Great.
You anywhere near
What part of the state is that?
Mamaroneck's about 40 minutes up from New York City.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's about how far I am from Denver, actually.
Gotcha. I flew through Denver last November. It was cold as hell.
Can be, yeah. Big airport, but yeah. Today it's about 95, so not cold at all.
Okay, everybody. Sorry to interrupt the gossip here. I hope you guys are taking good care of yourselves.
Hi, David.
Hey, how are you?
Good. It's Eric. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great. How are you?
Good. Ingrid and I were just getting acquainted.
Okay. I really appreciate the kind words and the responses and the answers to the questions each of you have sent in, and that really does make a difference, and I will integrate what you have emphasized, really wanting to get out of this and a destination for you in the discussion. So anything, we're going to talk about the neuroscience of persuasion today, mastering mindsets in a week, and finally putting it together for neuromarketing. Anything you want to add to what you mentioned or any questions or new information you got? Anyone?
Dave,
hi, David.
It's
Carlene.
Sorry, go ahead.
Carlene, yeah. Hey, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Eric. Sure. I just wanted to say there was definitely some new information, and I really appreciated it. It helped with some blocks I've had for quite a while. And one of them was just that an objection is a question in disguise. I absolutely love that. And that the person most flexible controls the situation. I actually never looked at it that way. I kind of beat myself up for being flexible. So when I saw that, I really appreciated it.
So
I'm looking forward to today and moving forward with this. It's been very helpful.
Well, great. Thank you. It's helpful to know what grabs you, what has impact, and is useful. So I appreciate that that feedback. Eric, you were about to say something.
No, it was Mike. Okay, go ahead. I had nothing to add, really.
Oh, okay.
So,
right.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Mike, go ahead.
Hi, Dave. We kind of went back and forth briefly in an email, but I just wanted to circle back on something. You know, I've been doing a little bit of work here and there with people on stress inoculation training. And, from some of the comments you raised last time, it seems like this is kind of almost the mirror image of that. And one of the things that I do with some of these people is focus on the reactivity of something you pointed out, which is the amygdala. And we talk about that when I work with these people and how the information that the stimulus you receive runs through your amygdala and gets to other parts of your brain before it gets to your cortex, before you can really analyze what's going on. And we just react. And I focus on it in a negative way in terms of stress and how we can kind of interdict those transmissions and learn to overcome them and actually have a conscious response instead of a reactive response. It seems like this is kind of the mirror image of that in the same way, from a positive point of view, rather than things like adrenaline and some of these other neurotransmitters. We're talking about dopamine and sort of the positive effects that run through the same system. And I was just wondering if you could comment on the overlap between those two and, you know, how much we may or may not be really in control of what we're thinking or doing or attempting to get to.
Okay, here's, are you willing to be coached by me for just a moment, Mike?
Sure.
Okay, here's my challenge. Put what you just said to me as if I were a new client. Make it experience near and understandable and in a positive way that I would want to sign on to work with you in one sentence of 12 words or less.
There are amazing...
Go ahead.
There are amazing things that we can do to actually get better control of how we react and turn our reactions into actions and control the situation rather than having the situation control us.
Okay. And since I'm the client, I want to hear it in terms of me. So I'm going to translate that into, I'm hearing you say this, and here are my 12 words to paraphrase that, because I'm hearing it from the standpoint of a client. You're going to help me manage and regulate my state of mind to achieve and sustain peak performance. That's what I want to hear. I don't want to hear nothing about no amygdalas. I don't care about my amygdala. I want to know how I'm going to make some more money, how I'm going to help people, how I'm going to fulfill myself, and what I'm doing while I'm, you know, ensconced here at home in these cargo pants until I can get out in a few months or a year or two to be able to really, really help people. And I need to hear it in a way that's experience near. So that's my suggestion to you. Let's do this. And this is to everybody. Take a piece of paper and draw a circle. Draw a big circle in the middle of that page. Now, in the middle of that circle, draw a stick figure. Now, that stick figure is your client. If you're talking to somebody about the possibility of mentor coaching, that's your client. If you're thinking about offering a service or a product to a very specific niche of people and you want it very specific because you want to know what that stick figure represents, what their challenges are, where their watering holes are, your challenge is to get inside that circle. Because if you don't get inside that circle, nobody's going to listen to you. If you get inside the circle, you have the possibility of collaborating to go someplace new together. And that's exactly one of the things we're going to be talking about today a bit more. And actually, I think we're going to begin with it in terms of how do you connect with somebody? How do you empathically resonate with their challenge, which gets you inside that circle? Then you have a common ground that you've co-created, then you can go someplace new together. And the challenge then is knowing what it is that's their challenge, what's going to resonate with their position, their experience. So you have to listen very carefully and you have to ask. Now, Mike, does that help? Now, to answer your question, as we talked last time, 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. So most of the things we talk about, we're going to, and that's why you guys are listening to me talk for 4 hours for, you know, looking at the psychology of influence and neuroscience of persuasion, mindsets and neuromarketing, because if it were simple, if it were all about information, be a slam dunk. You wouldn't need this. If it were logical and conscious and intellectual, nobody would need you as a mentor coach. So that's why we have to look at how do we create this bridge to resonate with and understand how the minds and brains of our clients work, what their emotion, what their experiences are, so that we can collaboratively move to a new position for them. Because that's what's unique about mentor coaching, the model of collaboration. Everybody else, every other professional, the model is consultative. They bring a problem, you ask some questions, and the expert, the doc, the dentist, financial, gives you an answer. And we've already talked about how well that works. It doesn't, because it's not about information. So, Mike, does that begin to answer your question?
Yeah, it actually gives it more direction.
Okay. Yeah. So, and this is where we have to remember, no matter how much we know, we have to resonate with the experience of the client and talk with them. When I talk with one of my, you know, buddies or people I know from, you know, my hometown and, you know, farming and ranching, you know, I don't talk about all this, you know, I help practicing and performing professionals achieve and sustain peak performance. I just say, I hope you do your business better, because that's the way they talk. I know that. So think about resonating with the person in front of you. Think about when you want to market, look at who you already know, your lowest hanging fruit, the people you already have relationships with, to let them know what you're up to now. That's the highest yield of any possibility. No matter how much you pay for ads or do all kinds of stuff, your lowest hanging fruit is the first thing to develop. So I'm going to be moving into what I'm supposed to be talking about now, although I enjoy conversing with you. We're going to spend a little bit, I'll reserve some time at the end for another question and maybe some discussion there. What might be helpful, what I'd like to do is add 15 minutes on to our final seminar. So at the top of the hour for week four, let's just have a discussion, or maybe before that even, but just to have a discussion. So any questions and things you want to talk about that we don't get to, we'll do then. We'll just tack that on the end for discussion time. So hold on. I'm going to put us on lecture mode, and we'll come back to a discussion time. Okay, as last time, let's start with a quiz. And the quiz is in your outline. Ohio State University studied several hundred undergraduates to ask to rate how much they wanted and liked different experiences and activities, receiving a paycheck, seeing a best friend, sexual activity, remember this is undergraduates, receiving a compliment or getting a good grade, or eating their most favorite food. Now, there's a hint. One of these was endorsed as much as the other four combined. So jot down your best guess. Now, the definition of persuasion is it's an active process of choice architecture. That's what we specialize in as mentor coaches, by the way, to get a prospect to clearly associate a desired feeling and outcome with your service or your product. Remember that the reason we decide anything we decide is how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. So, the most significant thing that great persuaders understand and communicate, it's not about you, it's about them. And that's exactly what I ask Mike to do, to shift, to make it clear, brief, and succinct to me, the client. And I wanted to hear it from that perspective, to see if there was anything I could be helpful in saying. And remember, your primary question is, what is it you want to accomplish through this? When President Abraham Lincoln was a successful lawyer prior to his presidency, he began by presenting a case and established a positive frame for him and his client that created a distinct advantage. He would begin every case by his opening argument to sum up the other side's position. He would point out the positive aspects of their position, how worthy of consideration they were, and established his credibility by demonstrating that he recognized the other side had a very legitimate view. He presented his client's side then in detail, and people would then listen carefully because his credibility was high. So, in other words, what he did as a first step, he got in the circle of the other side, and they listened to him. The judge and jury then both concluded that if he were so willing to give credibility to the viewpoint of the other side, if he was willing to join that circle, he must be honest and speaking from his heart. This frame of respect and understanding of the other person's point of view establishes a common ground, a connection, a necessary connection, before presenting your position. So let's talk about persuasion neuroscience now. Our aversion to loss, to avoid pain, is hardwired. We learn more quickly from pain than from pleasure because negative stimuli get more attention and response, and it's a lot more important for survival. Avoiding loss has kept us alive. Review, if you have a chance, my archived blog called The Allure of Chaos. It's kind of cycled back to have a new relevance here. Daniel Kahneman won a Nobel Prize by demonstrating that notions of loss are more powerful than focus on gain. He demonstrated that we register twice as much pain, for example, from losing $100, than the pleasure from gaining $100. This is measurable in the brain. It's called loss aversion, as you know. This means that people are more emotionally concerned with not making a bad decision than with making the best decision. In other words, they play not to lose rather than playing to win, which, of course, significantly affects performance in a negative way. Here's the principle, and here's what's going to be helpful, I think, in coaching your clients. From psychology and social neuroscience, we know the twin forces of motivation that drive all human behavior, the desire to avoid pain, the desire to seek pleasure. These two organizing principles of brain wiring to minimize danger or pain, to maximize reward or pleasure, are overarching. If we associate positive emotions or reward, we approach. If we associate negative emotions or pain, we avoid. So, what this means now, translated into our topic, if someone buys what you have to offer, let's say your coaching services, they associate more pleasure to buying than not buying. If someone doesn't buy, they associate more pain to buying than not buying. So we process the pain and pleasure cues unconsciously in a fifth of a second. And this goes to what Mike asked about. 90-95% of our operating system is unconscious. We make decisions. We know from neuroeconomics, a couple of neuroeconomics labs I correspond with, we make decisions like a purchase decision up to 10 seconds before we're even consciously aware of it, because we make it at the midbrain level and at the part of the brain that processes a sense of identity. We buy what we identify with. We're going to come back to that. So here's a master formula of persuasion: to associate buying with getting pleasure and not buying with pain. Greater gain with action, loss with failure to act. Since people will do more to avoid pain than to seek pleasure, both avoiding pain and inertia, remaining in the status quo, are two innate brain tendencies to be aware of. Short-term equals pain. You pay before you get the benefits. Giving up their money, for example. Most people need to think long-term to be successful, but that's way harder. That's abstract. That's tomorrow. Think about how much of what we do is to prevent pain. Paying bills, doing taxes, exercising, maintaining your house and car. Our brains are hardwired to prevent pain, to prioritize survival over improvement. This means that our brains are primarily a mechanism for survival rather than designated and designed for success, fulfillment, and growth. So now let's apply this pain and pleasure brain formula to the three story components we talked about last time. The challenge: find the need or the interest that's not fulfilled in that person. What your prospects want but aren't getting. The middle part of the story, the development: show how to meet the challenge and acquire, get what they want. And third, resolution, the conclusion of the story: clarify both the emotional and logical reasons to act. People want emotionally but justify logically. So, find emotional motivators to have or be the best for their clients, to have the best relationship or the best skill set, to be fully informed, to be confident. Since part of persuasion focuses on avoiding pain, if you focus on price, this adds to the pain rather than alleviating it, because money is something you got to give up right now. We keep things to avoid the regret we would experience in giving them up, including our money. Participants in a research study were given a lottery ticket and then asked if they would trade their ticket for a different one with an equal chance of winning. Less than half of the participants agreed, even when they were bribed by chocolate. Right there, right in front of them, chocolate. When the experiment was repeated with pins instead of lottery tickets, 90% of participants agreed to trade. Pins are tangible and real. Lottery tickets are a story of hope. Dopamine for a dollar. People hang on to lottery tickets to hope for the best and avoid the regret they might experience if they had switched and their original ticket won. So from a marketing perspective, here's a kind of a goofy example, not that you'd want to use it, but giving somebody $100 to be applied toward a future purchase is a greater incentive than a $100 discount. Consumer psychology tells us that people will gravitate toward purchasing decisions that do one or more of these five things: reduce the fear of making a mistake — this is why you get money-back guarantees — make them feel more in control, simplify the decision process, offer simple, clear, immediate emotional benefits — you get a free gift to download when you sign up — eliminate any obstacles. You may not have to start paying for a week or two, or it may be stretched out for equal payments. So here are six principles of persuasion. Now, persuasion appeals to deeply rooted human responses of mind and brain, strategies that simply inform people about facts and reasons to make changes are just not going to work. A high likelihood of failure is I was talking in the discussion, Pete, you can get all the information you want on the internet. People don't make decisions on the basis of facts and logic and reason or information. Information does not lead people to make decisions. If information would change behavior, we'd all be thin. We'd work out every day, we'd eat mostly vegetables, we'd have significant money saved up, and a bunch of librarians would be billionaires. And nobody would be talking about whether or not you wear masks. Also, I want to add that. The mind and brain sciences can tremendously inform persuasion to determine decisions and results. How information is communicated can dramatically affect how it's perceived and acted on. So let's look at these six principles of persuasion. Remember, the basics are in your outlines. You can listen and see if this makes sense. One, liking. We like people who like us, who are similar to us in some way. We buy from people we like. We prefer to say yes to people we know, like, and trust. The application: find something in common. Discover real similarities. Genuine connection. Offer authentic comments. Here's what I learned but didn't know that I learned at the time. When I was about 8 years old, it was time to buy a new coat for school. I went to the big city close to the little town, population 720, that I lived in. So we looked at coats, my mom and I, at the three stores, because that's all there were. Penny's, Sears, and Monkey Ward's. Don't even ask about that. At one store, I really liked the salesman. He was warm, engaging, funny, seemed to take a genuine interest in me. The coat I was looking at there was a light blue soft velour with an elastic bottom, sort of a balloon effect. You pretty much had to be there. He said, "Man, you look really good in that coat." Nobody had ever told me I looked good in a coat before. Right then I knew that was a coat I was going to buy. I just had to convince my mom. I emphasized to my mom how much I wanted that coat. I didn't particularly like coat, but I really liked the salesman. I liked the coat even less when I got home. That salesman had done a splendid job. I couldn't grow out of that coat fast enough. For 3 years, every time it got cold, I had vague memories of a very nice salesman while I looked like my head was on top of a light blue marshmallow. Now, here's an application that I'm calling the Magic Johnson Principle. When my son and daughter, there's a point here, so hang in. When my son and daughter began playing basketball in grade school, and I was coaching their teams, we had season tickets to the Houston Rockets. Two seats, and they would each do a draft at the beginning of the season to pick who went to what game with me. I was the constant, by the way, the designated one. And we would have dinner before the game. When the Lakers were in town, they were excited about seeing Magic Johnson. Before the game began, I would give them each a quiz. Notice how he plays and see what you can pick up about what his strategy is, especially about how he relates to everybody on the court. Now, my kids were 8 and 10 at this point as we began and hadn't developed the Magic Johnson Principle formally yet. After the game, I asked each of them what they noticed and to not tell the other about the answer. No trouble with that. They each mentioned how Magic seemed to be great friends with everybody on the court, including the opposing team players. What else, I asked? And the referees. He really enjoyed them, and they enjoyed anything else I nudged. They each mentioned, finally, some, and they knew enough about basketball to mention how much he actually fouled, but he never seemed to be called for the fouls. It was all done in a good-natured way, but he just wasn't called. Exactly. Everybody on the court likes him. All the players on both sides and the referees especially liked him. He would hug the opposing coach, and he genuinely seemed to like them. He was as expert at handling relationships as he was the ball, and they hardly ever called a foul on him. They participated in his success. They would be less likely to feel that and to participate in that success to break the spell, to break the state of mind and call a foul and disrupt the flow of that state of good energy experience with him. In his entire NBA career, Magic only fouled out of 5 games, lowest of any starter in the history of basketball. When people like you and sense you have something in common, they're more likely to say yes. It's the law of attraction in action. There's a brief white paper on my website under articles that's titled The Neuroscience of the Secret. People essentially do business with and refer business to those who they like, know, and trust. People commit not to things, but to people who they believe care about them. So, what are the factors that cause one person to like another person? Because they're not all visible. Here are 4 of the most common. The halo effect. The halo effect occurs when one positive characteristic of a person dominates the way that person is viewed by another. Examples: kindness, honesty, intelligence. We are always teaching people how to respond to us, and that comes across in our energy field. It's how we read people, so this has to be authentic. Secondly, similarity. We like people who are similar to us, similar backgrounds, interests, age, religion, politics. Roger Dooley, the author of Brainfluence, talked about this when he was the expert content contributor of my mastermind group not too long ago and illustrated it by pointing out how I used something I knew we personally had in common in my introduction of him. Wasn't intentional, but he used it, and it makes sense. Third, compliments. The greatest car salesman in the world, so-called, Joe Girard, said that the secret of success was mutually liking clients and customers. Each month, he sent every one of his more than 13,000 former clients a greeting card and a personal message. And the message always included this sentence, "I like you." And people who knew him said he totally and authentically meant it. And a fourth, contact and cooperation. Things that are familiar to us are most likely to persuade. By providing people with different backgrounds with more exposure to one another as equals, they come to like each other better. Mr. Rogers carried in his wallet a statement that said, "Frankly, there isn't anyone you couldn't learn to love once you've heard their story." We are wired to socially connect with others. A study in Edinburgh planted hundreds of wallets on city streets. The wallets contained one of four possible photos: a smiling baby, a cute puppy, a happy family, an elderly couple. Other wallets, a fifth set, had no photo at all. The percentage of wallets that were actually returned with money intact, with the baby photo, 88%. Puppy photo, 53%. Family photo, 48%. The elderly couple, 28%. Those with no photo, 14%. Second principle of persuasion, reciprocity. We repay in kind. People return favors. When we help people, they want to help us, because this induces oxytocin, the brain chemical of connection and bonding. So the application here may be to give what you want to receive. Your income is determined by how many people you serve and how well you serve them. When we behave in a certain way, such as cooperatively, someone will respond in kind. We try to repay in kind what another person has provided. It provides a sense of connection and closure. We have serious persuasive power immediately after someone thanks us. Of course, it's what partners do for each other. We make it about them and the us, not about us, the individual. In a number of studies, reciprocity is so strong that it overwhelmed all other factors. In one study, success in selling raffle tickets was most effective for subjects who received a free Coke. The feeling of wanting to reciprocate to the giver resulted in selling twice as many tickets as those who had not been given the favor of the Coke. Think of the address labels you get to get with a gift in request for a donation. In one study, shoppers at a candy store made 42% more purchases when they received a small gift piece of chocolate when they walked in. It activates the connection part of our brain and the oxytocin system. When reciprocity was meaningful and unexpected, the size of the tips that food servers received was impacted. To diners offered a piece of chocolate at the end of their meals by the waitress, tips increased almost 4%. To diners invited to take two chocolates from the basket, tips increased 14%. In another scenario, after offering guests one chocolate from the basket, turning away and unexpectedly returning to the table to offer a second chocolate, tips increased by 21.3%. Now, this sounds a little gimmicky. I'm not suggesting it be a gimmick, but just emphasizing the principle and the point here. The third principle of persuasion, social proof. We follow the lead of similar others, especially in ambiguous situations. And when we're uncertain, we do things we see other people doing, even more so if those people seem similar to us. So the application may be provide a context to guide or demonstrate adaptive behavior. Social proof is a way we determine what's correct or even acceptable. We find out what other people think about it. We even view behavior as more correct in a given situation as we see others performing it. In a study of donations to a street musician in Washington, D.C., researchers set two situations to observe the rate of donation to the musician. And at another match time, whenever someone was approaching the musician, one of the members of the study would drop some money in the hat of the street musician so that the approaching subject would see it. In other words, he'd kind of prime the collection jar. Viewing this act increased donation eight times, eightfold. In follow-up, not a single one of the people acknowledged being influenced by seeing the other person donate money that it had anything to do with what they did. Instead, they came up with various rational reasons, such as liking the music. This means that basing influence strategy on what people acknowledge that influences them can have a really high failure rate because people are often not consciously aware of what influences them or what to attribute as the cause. Add specificity to that. A study in Great Britain found the most remarkable success of getting people to pay delinquent taxes was the option, the number of people who were supplied to with the information that there were a specific number of their fellow citizens living in their zip code who were paying taxes. It induced them at a much higher rate to pay. Focus on behaviors that are frequently adopted and that are desirable. Work. Social proof and other influence factors have to be authentic, though, and ethical. And that's kind of the framework of everything I'm saying here. Fourth principle of persuasion, commitment and consistency. We have a deeply held motivation to behave consistently with our commitments that we've made, especially those commitments that have been made public to others. Remember, at the end of each session that you do mentor coaching, you ask what the client, after you've had them summarize what they put together, and then what do you commit to do before we meet again. The application, write it down and publicly declare a commitment. We're more likely to follow through when we put it into an output channel. Now, here's a question I'll bet you've already considered. What can persuade someone to keep an initial appointment with you? A series of experiments were done at three large doctor's offices where patients, immediately after being provided with a date and time in a standard appointment call, were asked to read back out loud those appointment details before hanging up the phone. The verbal commitment resulted and a significant increase in follow-through. They put it in the output channel. Now, here's a variation, though, that had even greater effect. When the receptionist gave the card and wrote down the appointment time and date to another matched group, she would give the card and ask the patient to write the time and date of the next appointment on the card to put it in an output channel there. The result, an 18% reduction in no-shows when the patient wrote it. The best chance of a commitment will be fulfilled when there's ownership of it. There's less commitment when somebody else writes out the plan. And you know that people will commit to what they help create. We learn and remember best when we use an output channel, writing notes, talking about what will engage. In instances where it's not reasonable for the client to actively participate in this way, it may be more productive just to get a response such as an email to simply check yes to confirm an agreement. This also enhances commitment rates. These are all ways to help people take ownership of their own stories and use the output channel and do it. The output channel completes the brain circuitry, and it makes a story more complete. And stories are how we remember, how we understand and recall things. We each have a basic desire to be and appear consistent with what we've already done. Once we make a choice, we justify and rationalize that choice. We gather data to confirm it and sometimes create a confirmation bias, selectively omit data that may refute it, and inattentional blindness. These internal and external pressures can cause us to respond to ways that justify our earlier decision and make it more consistent. We want to be consistent with what we've committed to do because it makes us more aligned with the sense of self that we put out there and really are. We make our beliefs and perceptions consistent with what we've already decided. This principle of consistency is powerful enough to direct both our perception and our action. A desire for consistency is strong enough to be a central motivator and organizer of our behavior. Both mind and brain incline toward the continuity of no change. A body at rest tends to stay at rest. A body in motion tends to stay in motion. Think about a continuity program. You get a free 3 months of a subscription, but you have to give them your card number, and they begin to charge the fourth month if you don't unsubscribe. Now, 65% of people don't read the subscriptions, but 82% of people don't unsubscribe. So that automatic consistency and maintenance of the status quo can be something that can be a consideration. Now, here's a question. How can you make positive use of this consistency principle in your own business? Now, this is what we know from copywriters, from marketers. To obtain a large purchase, start with a small one as an introduction to the benefits you can offer. Findings show that almost any small sale will do, like an ebook for a couple of bucks, because the purpose of the initial small transaction is not profit, but commitment to introduce yourself to begin a relationship. Further and future purchases to progressively larger ones flow naturally from this commitment. Plus, you establish a relationship and you begin to show the value of what you can offer. Fifth principle of persuasion, authority. We defer to experts and those in authority. The authority principle is an application, sort of the halo effect. So the application here, expose your expertise. Don't assume it's self-evident. Again, make it clear, brief, and simple so that somebody doesn't have to go through the cognitive strain of following you to come to the conclusion. When you need someone to advance your case, product, or service, having an advocate can be helpful. You're perceived as being more prestigious if someone is advocating for you. This is the idea behind book blurbs or endorsements from respected authorities. When you negotiate with an organization, if you can, first develop an internal champion. Thank you, Kay McConney, for that term. Within the organization who advocates and provides information. And the sixth principle of persuasion, scarcity. We want more of what we can have less of. People value things more when they perceive them to be scarce. Opportunities and objects seem more valuable to us when their availability is perceived to be limited. The application, highlight unique benefits and exclusive information. G.K. Chesterton said this in a very succinct way. The way to love anything is to realize it might be lost. Now, here's a practical application. Caitlin, my granddaughter, who was 4 at the time, was playing with a stuffed bear in her pre-kindergarten class. Sarah, her little buddy, suddenly decided she wanted to play with that bear as well. There were a lot of other toys around. There was no bear deficit. But Sarah was no longer satisfied until she had Caitlin's stuffed bear. Caitlin's mom, my daughter Lauren, a clinical psychologist, was rendered as helpless as Caitlin's absent granddad Dave in orchestrating her mastery to maintain possession of that coveted bear, or simply to work out a compromise for all-or-nothing four-year-old possession-oriented minds. Caitlin will later learn how her own desires will be influenced by neuromarketing techniques based on celebrity induction, social valuation, and popular trending stuffed bears, even the induced shortage of specific stuffed bears. But for now, she has only impromptu strategies to wrest her bear from the evil clutches of Sarah's immediately inspired desire. As all children do, they both had a radar for scarcity, the unequal distribution of wealth, tangible or emotional. Both girls were in the grips of the scarcity principle. When something becomes rare or scarce, it seems to become more valuable because it enhances desire. When increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we react by wanting to possess it even more. Later in their lives, Caitlin and Sarah will contend with market messages that are adult versions of the bear story. Limited number. Only 2 left. 1 day remaining. We're not making any more. Mimetic desire. One person's desire mimicking that of another is not limited to children, but plays a significant role in product adoption of best-selling goods. Our neural system contributes to this contagion of desire. The more valued the person, the more attention we pay to that mirroring process. The scarcity principle involves a secondary source of persuasion. As opportunities become less available, we lose freedom and choice, and we desire to preserve our established priorities. We need to couple not just what would be gained by acting or purchasing, but also what would be lost if someone does not act or purchase. With increasing scarcity, it can interfere with our access to something, then we'll react by trying to possess that item even more than before. A related tendency is to want what's been banned and to presume that that it is more worthwhile when it's limited. In fact, Louis Neisser said, some people will believe anything if you whisper it to them. Here's a simple, I think, example. Many years ago, in my former life and career, after I completed my subspecialty training in psychoanalysis, I was invited to join the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Institute. I was even more excited when I was also invited to offer a continuing education course in the evening for the professional community on any subject I chose. That, to me at the time, was a plum. I was warned, though, not to be disappointed if the enrollment was low, because the highest subscription for any course that had been offered to date was 7 people. The average was 4 to 5, and occasionally courses had to be dropped because there wasn't enough registration or no registration. So I didn't know this at the time. I can't even claim it to be intuitive, but first thing I did when announcing a course was to stipulate, in order to ensure optimum discussion, a maximum of 12 seats was available. The natural part was I was an optimist, and I was really looking forward to having these. And I didn't know consciously at that time about the scarcity principle. In the first 2 days, 14 people signed up, and the waiting list grew. So here's a brief overview of these 6 principles of persuasion that apply the mind and brain principles. Liking and reciprocity highlight connectedness with others to generate positive association. Shared similarity, being together and acting together, creates a sense of unity which activates the hormone of connection, oxytocin. Social proof and authority both reduce uncertainty. Consistency and scarcity both motivate action. The most important thing in knowing and applying these persuasion principles is to be authentic, to genuinely have your client's best interests at heart. Remember that all influence factors have to be genuine, trustworthy, and ethical. And I want to conclude by four primary tools of persuasion to apply these principles. One is relatedness and connection. For a long-term impact, you have to care about people and find a way to communicate that feeling of caring and of connection. Empathy is a listening position of resonating with someone else's experience, including feelings, perspective, ways of constructing meaning, the person's subjective reality, in other words. Our ability to influence and persuade depends not only on our ability to empathically understand the other person, but to communicate that understanding. This is always a first step to empathically resonate with someone to build a common ground of understanding. Everything else follows. This is getting inside that circle. If you're not exactly right when you empathically resonate, the other person appreciates that you've attempted to understand, they'll correct you. When you listen empathically and communicate that understanding, the other person feels truly heard. This is the essence of effectiveness, to be understood. The experience of connecting with another person releases oxytocin in the brain of both parties, and that neurochemical system processes everything that follows. So here's the answer, as you've guessed already, most likely, to the persuasion quiz at the beginning of this seminar, Ohio State University, the option that's the generator of self-esteem, the other four are markers. The student's valued boost to their self-esteem, such as receiving good grades or compliments, more than the other four combined. Relatedness, connectedness, and effectiveness. The second tool of persuasion, autonomy. To have mastery, control over our environment and our choices, generates the experience of significance, to feel important, unique, effective. When you understand what people believe and need, you can then show how your service or what you'll do together will help them be effective to reach their goals and experience mastery. Remember, this is not about you. This is not about your training, your degrees, your credentials, all of that. It's about them. The third tool, certainty. The need to be certain that we can avoid pain and achieve pleasure is a basic need and motivation. The brain is a pattern recognition machine that constantly tries to predict the near future. The act of creating a sense of certainty is rewarding. Think about how we repeat patterns. We listen to the same music. We go back to the same places we've been. We go in a restaurant, look at the menu, and back in the day, but we order the same thing. Change generates uncertainty. Even a small amount of uncertainty cues the brain's error detection mechanism, and it contributes to a sense of resistance or just of status quo. Thanks. I think I'll stay where I am. We can increase certainty by making concepts tangible, such as how long a meeting will run, and explicit, such as the objectives. Remember, clarity, brevity, simplicity, humanity. Go for the behavioral science technique of cognitive ease. Make it easy to remember, to process, to come to a conclusion. Here's a principle, or a sub-principle here under certainty. Whenever two people meet, the person with the greatest amount of confidence will influence the other. Confidence is a state of mind that infers certainty, and confidence, as every state of mind, is hugely contagious. These first three primary tools of persuasion comprise three of the basic six human needs: connection, autonomy, and certainty. The fourth tool of persuasion, state management. This is so important. We're going to spend our next seminar really talking about this and how to understand it. The upshot of managing your emotions and state of mind is that focus is one of the two most powerful ways we regulate state of mind. We determine someone's focus by the questions that we ask. Asking questions is our most powerful tool to persuade someone. And the way we ask the question frames the answer. We'll explore more about that considerably in the next seminar. So I want to conclude with something that has been a question. I've seen this consistently in the questions that you've sent in, the things that you want to walk away with. There's an art and science of explanation. A natural inclination is to point to all the available information and a rationale for why people should pay attention to it. Yet, when a medical doctor prescribes a medication, over 50% of prescriptions are not filled. Those that are filled, just over 50% of those are not taken as prescribed. Less than 1 in 4 respond to information, even from an expert, even when they're scared. Strategies that attempt to inform people into a desirable change have a high likelihood of failure. It's not information that leads people to make decisions. We all, to some degree, have to overcome the curse of knowledge, the difficulty that we have in imagining what it's like to not know what we know. The killer pairing, and I know this very well, is to want to share all that we know. One of the most profound challenges is to simplify. Although valuable, the knowledge we bring to the table, especially if we get into a teaching mode, is going to interfere with our ability to engage in conversation and communicate in a simple, clear, succinct way. So these principles from a number of neuroscience studies will heighten impact and retention. These are, as I've alluded to, the four principles of good writing as well as good speaking: clarity, brevity, simplicity, humanity. When you speak to others, they will only be able to fully process and recall about 10 to 12 words before their attention begins to slip. Consider the 10-10 principle. A collaborator of mine, Mark Wallman, Loyola Marymount Executive MBA faculty, did research using this 10-10 principle. Hold both fists in front of you. Raise one finger every time you use a word. When you run out of fingers and thumb, when you run out of digits, you have to stop speaking. This will quickly train your brain to use 10 words in order to speak with clarity, brevity, and simplicity. His research showed that in charged situations like divorce, mediation, negotiation, arbitration, when both parties agreed to do this, they resolved faster, averaging 20 to 25% of the usual time, and they reached more satisfying results and more complete conclusions than they ever had before. He describes this and related aspects in his book, Words Can Change Your Brain. So, there are basically 3 or 4 considerations to heighten impact and retention. Don't bury the lead. State in your first sentence what you want to address, then the benefits you bring. Think about your hub statement. Listen carefully. Knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. Reduce noise. Include only what's simple and relevant, the essence of what you want to say. For example, if you ask a question, make it clear, specific, succinct. Then pause. Don't elaborate, explain, stack on another question, or try to slip in an answer disguised as a question. And lastly, have fun. States of mind are contagious. And I want to close with the words of my favorite grandmother, because I think this says so much about so much. She said, "If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right." Okay, hold on. We'll move to discussion. Thoughts or questions or clarifications about anything we discussed? At this making sense to you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Questions,
yes,
or clarifications from anyone?
No. I think all of the conversation, everything you shared, David, just kind of rang true for me in practice and working with clients. This has been incredibly valuable for me and will have immediate application. Just all of those points about keeping the client, keeping it centered. Sometimes we can forget. I loved your conversation with the young man that you spoke to about our knowledge. As a practitioner, that's one of my reminders. That was an important reminder for me. They don't care about your knowledge and your brain or the amygdala. I'm going to remember that.
Yeah.
You've said it before, and sometimes we can fall short and start providing more information.
You sound very much like a good friend and admired colleague of mine named Bonita Cartwright.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Okay.
I'm sticking this in as
best
I can.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, it helps me. So thank you. Everything is
great.
Relevant.
Okay, super. Other thoughts, questions?
I think as you were talking, Dave, I agree that it was resonating with me a lot, Carlene speaking. I also realized that it's a really fine line, and I think this is the skill of a good coach, say between scarcity and pressure sales or confidence and overconfidence. Because I know, having worked with different people, that it is a fine line. There's just a fine line there. If I feel I'm being pressured, I won't buy. If I feel someone's overconfident, I walk away. There's a fine line.
Both of those that you point out, I think very wisely, make it about the person rather than about you. And the key is to make it about the client, to make it about the person who you want to help, nothing about you, the person who's trying to sell, about the information, about all the experience we've had and all of the titles. I mean, none of that make any difference, and it shouldn't. It's all about the person, because that's the spirit. That's getting inside the circle.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't want to leave a leg or two dangling outside the circle. Go all in, resonate with the person, and then you can go someplace new together.
Mm-hmm.
The most succinct, some of you have heard this very brief, and I know we're over, but if you'll give me about 20 more seconds. The most succinct and wisest supervision I've ever had about this, back in the day when I was doing psychoanalysis, I worked with an executive woman. I offered an interpretation that I thought was going to be really helpful. Instead, there was silence. So I knew something was up. And finally, she got up on her elbow, looked back at me in my analytic chair, and she said, "No, Kruger, first you've got to be with me before I can go someplace new with you."
Mm-hmm.
The most elegant, the most succinct of anything I've ever heard in terms of supervision about this process and about the whole aspect of working with clients in coaching, that it's about their experience. It's not us ghostwriting their story, running in plays, or trying to slip in an answer we think might work better than what they, you know. So these are all important aspects. Thank you for highlighting that, and I appreciate it. I know we're over. Thanks for all of your attention, energy, all the correspondence that you sent. I appreciate it. I look forward to picking up right here next time. Have a great week. Take care of yourself.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
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 You guys.
Bye. Bye. Awesome.
Thanks. Good night.
Good night, all.
Thank you. Good night. Good night.